Tú me pones un éxito. Si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk, real people, real stories. The He's Just podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. You know, violence has a significant implication on our public health, on our social stability and economic development. Violence can have profound and lasting effects on our society as individuals and collectively. Meet Dr. Rob Gore, an emergency room physician at Kings County Hospital Center. He has profoundly impacted violence throughout his life. Starting from a young age, his personal experiences with violence, including being robbed and beaten at 10, and facing violence again as a teenager. This has fueled his dedication to combating it, witnessing the effects of violence on his family and friends who also have been impacted. Dr. Gore founded the Kings Against Violence Initiative, CAVI, with the mission to harness the potential of young people to create a more just and peaceful world. Through CAVI, his aims are to address the root causes of violence and provide support and resources to those affected. His efforts have been widely recognized with appearances on BET, New York Times, CNN, and TED Residency Talk titled Healing Inner City Trauma in July 2016. His new book, Treating Violence, an Emergency Room Doctor, takes on deadly American epidemic. This explores the epidemic of violence in America and his experiences and insights as an ER doctor. Supporting Dr. Gore's mission can involve raising awareness about CAVI, advocating for violence prevention programs, and contributing to community initiatives that promote peace and justice. Yes, we can. Together, we can stop the violence. Dr. Gore, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me today. Appreciate you.
It's such an honor to have you, and I know you and I were chopping it up a bit. Just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, and how did you get involved in this walk, in this journey?
I'm an emergency physician, and I happen to grow up in Brooklyn, New York. I grew up in, I like to say, pre-gentrified Brooklyn, because Brooklyn was a very different kind of space. We didn't have, there were no high-rises, and it's kind of funny, like looking right now, and yeah, Brooklyn has an actual landscape. That's noticeable from afar. But we grew up in a place that was home. Nobody looked at it as something odd where the community that you lived in was so different from somebody else's. It was home. You had people who worked, people who lived, people who played, people who experienced life. It just so happens that there's some things that were taking place in the 1980s and 1990s. And unfortunately now, it was impacting our very lives. And that was interpersonal conflict or actual violence. And, you know, I grew up in a household of change makers. My mother is a retired teacher, and she taught in Bed-Stuy and pre-gentrified Fort Greene for a number of years, and always wanted to make sure she was in a position to help elevate the level of her students and provide resources and help them become the scholars that they knew they had the potential to become. My father, you know, has a background in television production and media, but he's also a community organizer and had been doing activism work in Chicago, where he grew up since the 1960s, and then continued that stuff on in Boston and continued it on in Buffalo, New York, and continued it on in New York City. And he still does organizing, maybe not as intensely as he did before, but definitely in the consultant role with really helping foster change. And so this is the kind of environment that I grew up in. And a lot of the conversations that we would have, you know, at dinner, at any place, really, I don't even want to say it was dinner or lunch or breakfast, but I was taught to really be observant of the environment, Who's there? Who are the people there? Why does this happen in this community? What happens in this community compared to another community? How do you relate your experiences living in one place to some of the experiences that you might have see in someplace else that we've been fortunate to visit? And so I was always paying attention. But I remember there was a key conversation that I had with my father. And I think I was asking him why he did television production and why he was doing media. And he kind of reflected back on a story from when he was growing up on the west side of Chicago. He had an opportunity to go to a youth retreat that was sponsored by the Chicago Freedom Movement. And the people who were going to be in attendance at this retreat that happened to be in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, were members of Dr. King's organization, SCLC. Dr. King would also be a keynote speaker at this small retreat, which might have only had maybe about 200 plus people there. It wasn't a very big, it wasn't like an arena size thing, but it was really helping to show young people how to more effectively organize as a part of their civil rights to engage in protests and create change. And when I asked my dad started telling me this story, and he said when he heard that, he went on the retreat just trying to get away from his family on the west side of Chicago. And it's like, you know, it's also kind of cool. You might be able to meet Dr. King. But when he said King started speaking, and he's also listening to the other members of his inner circle, one in particular, C.T. Vivian, who became my dad's mentor, he said something just kind of took over him. And when he came back home to Chicago, he said, my life can't be the same. I have to continue to do this change work on an even larger scale. But when I asked him specifically about the media, he said, you know, he had always wanted to do television and media, but when, you know, having this fascination with this new-ish technology, and then learning how to become a change agent, he said, whatever I do, I need to make sure that we're in a position to help show our people at their best. Mm. And with that, no matter what was done, it was, you know, how do we elevate, you know, our role, our experiences, and really create opportunities that are going to foster a level of growth and development so that we can do more than just survive as a people. You know, that combined with my mom's experience in education, I'm the offspring of that. So a lot of the conversations that I have and the things that I think about really kind of come back to these early experiences where my parents talked about how do you understand community, how do you understand people, and how do you help foster and create change in these spaces that we live in?
So big up to your parents, of course, and all parents who step up and try to connect with their children around the realness of what is around our own surroundings. Why is this anti-violence movement for you so important?
It's funny. You have the anti-violence component, and then there's also the pro-life and the pro-wellness movement that are also tied into this. I've been a physician. This is my 22nd year as a physician, and I have practiced in both New York City for the past 18 years. I'm practicing at Kings County Hospital, and also I was at SUNY Downstate Medical Center right across the street. But I began practice. I did my residency training in Chicago at Cook County Hospital. Combined with these experiences of seeing young people who are coming in as victims and survivors of violence, it has a very different effect when you're working in the community that you're from, and also if you're working in a place where your family is. Like my dad grew up on the west side of Chicago. Cook County Hospital is on the west side of Chicago, and mm-hmm. our family used that place, just kind of like being back in Brooklyn where our family and friends and neighbors go to Kings County Hospital. You just told me a little bit earlier, you were born at Kings County Hospital. Yeah. And things have a very different effect when you're connected to individuals who are experiencing hardship and challenges that you potentially foresee as being avoidable. I also had, so that's part of the lens in which I see things. I also had a foster brother growing up who is a brilliant artist, brilliant creative, but because of the circumstances in which he grew up in, he entered the justice system exceptionally early and really unfairly. Mm. But because, and then on top of that, having a lot of other challenges with his immediate family that really wasn't designed to have him have the most favorable outcomes. And when he enter the justice system. And, you know, I really had a chance to reflect on that as a much older person. You know, I always wish I could have done something a little bit differently. I wish I was a lot more supportive of him when I was in high school than when I was in college, even though we were in two different cities. You know, contemplating what took place retrospectively is very uncomfortable. And, you know, seeing a lot of the correlations with the young patients that we were seeing who were coming in as survivors and victims of violence, and reflecting on the challenges my brother had growing up and entering the justice system, a lot of the risk factors were the same. And it really kind of came back to, how do you enhance support systems for people who have experienced hardship, who've experienced a lot of different challenges and experiences that will unfortunately have negative impacts on their life and impact their survivability. And, you know, just seeing these cases, reflecting on past experiences, and now, you know, as a young physician, being in a position where people are asking very critical questions about why things are taking place, and looking to you almost as an interpreter of what's happening to them, and explaining the language that's being used by the medical community because they've experienced a trauma and they're scared, they're freaked out, they're panicking because of concern of their life potentially leaving. Having these intimate conversations with a lot of young people would kind of prompted me saying, you know, I need to do something a little bit differently other than just treating patients, and which is almost a Band-Aid approach, because so many patients who were injured will come back with repeat injuries.
You know, talking about what this means for us and you and I having this linkages also had me thinking about different things. As I hear your answer, I'm visualizing myself also visiting my brother who was incarcerated for some time. And I didn't have an outlook or a present level that I thought I can go to, but I do remember how difficult it was for me to place that guilt on myself. Like, I have more responsibility to do something. Where did I lose contact? What did I do to kind of impact his scenario? Had I been there? Had I asked questions? Had I learned about that? And growing up in neighborhoods such as ours, it's very easy to get caught up. And many people who look at these stats and they notice that the minorities such as ourselves are the ones who are at the top of that. But when you look deeper, it really is not about the numbers or the stats. It's the lack of resources that we do have to tap in. And many of us do get caught up in situations, but it's almost like running in a hamster wheel. We're just running across something. The only things that are near our neighborhood is crime, drugs, violence. And these are the things that we get caught up around. So I do share with you that sentiment. And at the same time, I also heard you say the second time I had a chance to do that from a professional level had me noticing, maybe this is my call. Maybe this is my time. And me too, from the education side of things, I've tried to do that to my students. And I lead with that. I'm from the streets as well. I know what this looks like. And I can tell you that them having a safe space, a person who can be that interpreter, is key. So I really shout out the work that you do and anyone else who is in the field trying to model using themselves as examples, because I think that this is so difficult. But as a doctor, you often see firsthand the impacts of violence in its physical form, if you will. Yeah. Why is this so difficult for you as a Black man to have to now interpret this?
So I was a resident physician from 2002 to 2006 at Cook County Hospital. And I was in my late 20s when I was a resident physician. The patients who came in, who were, you know, majority of the victims or survivors of violence, were the same age as me. And, you know, back then, homicide was the number one cause of death for Black men ages 15 to 34. Right now, homicide is the number one cause of death for Black men ages 15 to 34. Number two cause of death for Latinx males ages 15 to 34. And when you see things up close and personal, one, when you can disconnect from anything, or what do they call it when somebody's experienced a trauma? They call it disassociation. When you can disassociate, there's no emotional connection. It's almost like you're this zombie. But when you're completely connected and you look at the patients, or you look at, in your case, maybe the students that you work with and former clients that you had as a social worker, when you were deeply connected to them and you see yourself in them, it no longer becomes an us versus them. It is, this is us. This is our people who are being impacted by this. And some of the, my outlook was really more of a self-preservation. What makes them any different from me? If I'm in the wrong place in the wrong time, you know, and I lived on the south side of Chicago, we had patients coming from the south side of Chicago. My family lived on the west side of Chicago. We had patients coming from the west side of Chicago. I'm visiting them. I happen to be in the wrong place, wrong time. It could really easily be me who's on one of these stretchers as a patient, as a client. And I, you know, again, you know, I talked to my parents about change and why did they enter education? Why did they do activism work? It's like, look, if it's not us who's going to do it, who's going to do it? You can't expect other people to take more of an active role in your overall well-being. And I recognize that, you know, I had been in a very fortunate situation to have access to education, to be able to travel around the world and to be able to connect with very different people, and really having the resource that took me beyond survival. I wasn't worrying about how I was going to eat and where I was going to sleep. I might have been worried about my occupation and doing well in residency and learning as much as possible and not getting yelled at because I screwed something up. But I really had more than ample opportunities to reflect on the situation and process what was taking place. And because I was very conscious of what was going on and having background of people who were connected to me who were change agents, you have to consider, what can I do to fix this problem that moves beyond just putting a Band-Aid on it, knowing that these patients are going to come back? And, you know, what if I'm the person who comes back? There was a situation that took place in, this was August of 2005, where it was, you know, August in the summertime in Chicago, or July, anytime it's really hot outside in places that are under-resourced, sometimes it can be a lot of conflict. And those hottest days where everybody's uncomfortable, those conflicts seem like it's even worse. But there was a day I was working in the trauma emergency department. And, you know, you know, most people hear about emergency departments. Cook County Hospital had a specific trauma emergency department that saw nothing but trauma. Because there was so much violence that was taking place and so many accidents that were taking place. And this day happened to be very cold and it was raining. It was in the 50s. And so we didn't have a lot of patients who were coming in who were injured due to violence. We had like people who came in because they were in a car crash. But one of my coworkers, you know, shouted out that he was bored, and a lot of people chimed in and said that they were bored too, because there was nothing going on. We didn't have social media. Well, I think they had like social media, like Black Voices on AOL, but nobody had smartphones because they didn't exist. I think we had iPods if you were fortunate to be able to purchase them, but nobody had, there were no smartphones. There were no social media at your fingertips in your pocket. So the time spent in boredom was very real. And then the same doc said that he hoped something exciting would come in, because that meant you got a chance to do some sort of procedures, but it also meant that there were going to be young Black or Latinx males who were coming in as victims and survivors of intentional acts of violence or intentional trauma. And I'm looking around the room, and the only two people of color were me and one of the clerks. Mm. And the patients who came in with this were always my age, and they came from neighborhoods that either some of my family members lived in, or neighborhoods that I would pass through, or even some cases where I lived. And it just kind of hit me all of a sudden. It's like, man, I don't want to treat somebody as an experiment. And, you know, if I come in because I'm in the wrong place, wrong time, is everybody going to be chiming in and saying, yeah, I hope something exciting comes in? And they're smiling because they get to cut somebody's chest open or put in a chest tube or put in a breathing tube. Mm-hmm. It becomes more of an experiment and an exercise rather than a type of personal engagement that should involve a level of compassion. Because somebody is on the brink of potentially losing their life. And I began studying the work. I said, I need to learn how to do these procedures, but I also need to learn how to do some things that prevented people from becoming patients, and began studying and looking at violence through this public health lens. using some of the work of Dr. John Rich and Dr. Arthur Kellerman, speaking about violence and trauma as these public health things, meaning if we understand risk factors, if we identify that they're risk factors and we understand that they're risk factors, then we can potentially intervene in these issues of violence, much like any other public health issue that's out there. And because violence was so widespread and unfortunately still is widespread, there's more than enough work that needs to be done, but it has to be engaged through a very preventative lens and through an actual restructuring of environment and enhancing support systems that are going to improve the quality of life so that people don't get caught up in certain issues that are connected them to be able to solve their conflict through acts of intentional violence.
Heavy on the words again. I think that for us, we have to start understanding that there is so much that can impact us, even in our own professions. There are many times that we're caught up just because the way that we look and sound, it can really impact. And you talk about this economic side of things. You know, there are workers, those of us that work in low wages industries, we're more than likely to be faced with stalking, which also may lead to violence. We get caught up in sexual assaults, in DV. I mean, looking at some of these CompStat numbers, murder in 2024, 6. In 2023 was 13, rape 41. Currently in 2023, there were 19 robberies, just about the same at 352, 349 in 2023. Federal assaults, 686. This year, last year, 660. Burglaries at 214. In 2023, 249. So on and so forth. And when you start to look at that and you start thinking about your conversation, what that was, it's me and the clerk. Mm-hmm. And now we're in the situation that it's like, I could easily go outside right now to get a Snickers bar and so happen to have a hoodie and get mistaken because I look like someone who they were looking for. And next thing you know, long story short, a professional who had nothing to do with it is caught up on that bed that we are talking about. So again, we must think about the words that we use when we are around one another, no matter the race or gender. We need to be careful how we do that because the words that we are lacing out are very offensive in content and experience. What are some of the positives that you are seeing in the hospital during your tenure that you're saying, okay, these are some things that I did not see before. I do like where this is going.
Last night, early this morning, I dropped off one of the staff members in the hospital. This is a young man who works in the ER and in the hospital as a transporter. This young man named Johannes was also one of my students 10 years ago and was in our violence intervention program, CABI. He had been born with some physical challenges and was bullied a lot. And because he was getting bullied, he started fighting a lot in school. And because he was fighting a lot in school, he wanted to make sure that this became something even more important and wound up joining a gang. Now, Johannes is working in the hospital. He's doing well. We were talking, he's going back to school. He's in the process of enrolling in college. And I'm so proud of him because I remember, and just listening to how he's articulating things that he's seeing in the community and looking at connecting the dots that can help cultivate change and well-being. I had a really proud moment. I look back at one of the pictures that he and I took. This is easily when he was in middle school, when he first started in our program, and to see the young man that he's becoming and looking at how do I do this stuff on a larger scale and how do I engage with people. But now, because he's in the hospital working, even if it's just as a transporter right now, he's connecting dots and seeing the correlations with everything from poverty to being disregarded, how stress impacts, how people engage with other people. If somebody's stressed out and dysregulated, a lot of times they can start taking it out on the person who's there, not because they were the initiator of or the reason why that person is to be stressed out, but you just happen to be the messenger, the person who's physically there, and how that stuff can be turned to you. So he's picking up on these insights, but And I think a lot of us already understand this stuff, but now he's starting to really, on purely on his own, understand the science behind it. And I had a really proud moment because I remember where he was when I first met him when he was 11 or 12 years old. The other day we had a tree planting ceremony that Kavi and Kings County Hospital sponsored, and we planted a tree in front of the hospital. And that tree, you know, over time is gonna grow, but it was to commemorate and it was also to provide remembrance of people who lost their lives due to violence. Mm-hmm. There were some nurses who were there, who work in the hospital, work in the Department of Emergency Medicine, and their family members were patients of ours in the ER, in the Department of Trauma, but also patients that we saw as an organization, Kavi. Kavi itself is a hospital, school, and community-based organization focusing on violence prevention and having people understand trauma and be able to process that trauma. But here we are, there's an organization that I founded that the community supports, that the hospital supports. And you never think of one of your own or people connected to your own as having to have your services. But one of our ER nurses' sons was shot. He survived the injury. But she thanked me multiple times. She said, I don't know what we would have done if it weren't for the support of our department and the organization that we founded. Mm-hmm. And that meant a lot to me. On one hand, you know, you're pissed that it took place. You're upset that somebody's loved one had to experience, you know, had them experience some sort of violent trauma. And they too were worried about their own life being impacted because people might know where you live. They have your ID cards. But just being in a position to help provide an additional support system that has been very helpful for her and her family meant a lot. And just, you know, she finally came back to work about a week ago and was, you know, she thanked me last night for the work that was being done. That means a lot. And that means there's still more work to be done because our goal is not to have to treat people who were patients. And so if we're still having people who are coming in as patients because of acts of intentional trauma or violence, then that means there's a lot more work to be done. Conflict, yes, we understand that takes place, but it doesn't have to engage in somebody's potentially losing their life, not necessarily. But we are happy we have the support. We are happy that our movement is growing, but we're more importantly, we're happy that we're in a position to be able to provide a resource that wasn't there initially.
Well, again, shout out Kavi in the movement, but I also want to big up again the positive males who are out here putting themselves to model. And I want to put myself under that umbrella as well. I try to model myself to be an example, and by no way, shape, or form am I perfect. Neither are you or none of us, because either we are laced with secondary trauma. We've been dealing with things from the past and probably still are dealing with them just based on where we live and what we look like. A lot of what you said to us right now had me thinking about some of the easy steps that we can take. Some of that incidental emotional response, something that probably stems from the Knicks losing a game. I'm walking down the street. First person I run into probably has a jersey that's of the winning team or said something to me versus that leads to something that's unnecessary. And behold, we wind up at your other place of residence, which is not the best place to be because you have to get treatment. And many a times we're sitting there, why did I even do that? Why did I even think of that? So listening to your former student and his development tells us that there are second chances for us. And these are things that we need to continue because more than likely, if we don't have luck on our side and things don't happen to go the way that they sort of should have went, we may wind up in a bad situation. Even though we live in a nice neighborhood now that's up and coming, we are still caught up just because of what we look like and what we talk like. I want to talk a little bit more about your book, which I already have uploaded to my website, Treating Violence, An Emergency Room Doctor Takes on a Deadly American Epidemic. Why was it so important for you to write this book?
It was the book itself, one, it was a way for me to process a lot of the experiences that I had, you know, as a physician and working in spaces of trauma. And, you know, as anyone who's working in an emergency environment, first responders, even educators or any kind of caretaker, we often will put other people's lives before our own, especially if that's your occupation. You got to treat an emergency. Your goal is to keep somebody alive. But the fact that you have a job that you're doing doesn't take away from the fact that you might have been dealing with your own stressors. And when you're dealing with an emergency, sometimes you have to compartmentalize the stressors and the things that you've experienced in the past, just so that you can focus. When you see somebody who's been badly injured or experienced trauma, it's a lot to take on, but you can't worry about, you know, oh my gosh, this person is uncomfortable and this looks like somebody that I know. You got to compartmentalize those emotions in many instances to focus on the task at hand, and that is keeping that person alive as long as possible and making sure that whatever we do, we can minimize the amount of harm that takes place. In an ideal world, you go back and process those emotions that you've experienced when you take on trauma, when you're dealing with the stuff, the stress from your kids, your family members, not having enough, worried about losing your house, your apartment, worried about your loved one's health. In an ideal situation, you have the space to process it. What actually happens is that we wind up covering those stressors up and we move on to the next. We suppress it, we avoid, and move on to the next. But in an ideal situation, when you can actually sit still and reflect on what's taking place, it's like, wow, you know what? I was at work and we took care of a few people that almost died. We had to tell a mother or her a father or a loved one that their child had been, you know, lost their life due to violence or some sort of complex medical issue or a fluke medical problem that took place and we don't know why that person died. And you're hearing the crying and the screams. That's a lot of emotion to take on. But then we move on to the next thing. We just act like, oh, I'm supposed to be tough. I'm supposed to be resilient. And I'm supposed to be this super, super strong person that I can withstand anything. But when you go back and you process those emotions, you think about and consider there was a terrible experience that just happened. This is what took place. Why am I even tearful right now? Why am I fearful of what happened? It's like, oh, because this person may have looked like my child. This person looked like my cousin or my aunt. And even talking with other people, it helps us. One, it helps foster a level of community. And it also helps us regulate our emotions because now we are processing what negative experiences we've seen. When you don't process those emotions, they build up and build up and build up. And they can cause us to be very dysregulated once you have a major stressor that comes on. It's like the straw that broke the camel's back. Mm-hmm. If you've never regulated your emotions, if you've never figured out developed a system to process a lot of the trauma that you've experienced, either as a caretaker, as a person in a helping profession, as a physician, surgeon, ER tech, nurse, if you've never gone back to those and been in a place to be able to process those emotions, all it takes is for you to have one more intense case or one person who knows exactly how to push your buttons, mm-hmm. and then everything gets regurgitated. And you unleash a level of fear and ferociousness and harsh words that can be traumatizing to the other person, in many of which you can't come back to because this person is experiencing all this intense emotion coming from you. And then, you know, naturally, if somebody's coming at you, you're going to protect yourself. And if you get backed into a corner, you may retaliate. So you have a lot of people who've experienced so much trauma who've never processed it. And because they haven't processed it, they're experiencing high levels of dysregulation. And that the person who was this nice person who was very peaceful has now become this time bomb. And now they've become this bomb, this weapon. They're unleashing this power that on anybody and anybody who comes in their path. And it, in some cases, depending on how you look at it, if you've experienced trauma because it was directed to you, you say, oh, no, this is not going to happen to me again. You are not going to take advantage of me. I am not going to be your prey. And so the person who was the prey becomes the predator. Mm. And the predator, you're going to ensure that your survival instincts kick in and you're going to do whatever it is to stay on top, become this apex predator and to stay on top of this pyramid so that you maintain your position of power and you maintain your position of well-being. So part of really, you know, writing this book was a way for me to express a lot of the emotions and things that I've been taking on for 20 plus, 30 plus years, you know, working in the community, being in the community, even just processing my own traumas, but then providing a template for other people to say, you know what, you don't have the same experiences, but they may be somewhat similar. And I like kind of having a systematic approach. It doesn't mean that that's the only approach that you can have, but having a template, you know, you as an educator are in an amazing position to give people tools that can help them learn and solve problems effectively. You don't have to use your tools in the same exact way, but having something that provides a foundation or a base at least can give you the flexibility to say, you know what, I like what this is, I don't like what this is, but it's written in a format that I can come back to. And if you can go back to it, that means it's a resource. And so if you forget something, you can always go back to it. And so I wanted the book to be a reflection. I also wanted it to be a almost a guide to help people learn how to, you know, treat violence and understand and process their own experiences and draw on the experiences of others. And then have it really written almost in a discussion format to be able to help people be in the best position to process what some of the things that they've experienced and share that with others.
You know that as a minority myself, you know, I look to you and just empowering words that you continue to lash out. But I'm also impacted in a positive, just saying to myself, when we are growing up for minority families, we are either going to be some sort of sports star or we're going to be a doctor. And these are the two like top kind of professions. And then educators fall in between that, like lawyers and whatnot, because it's so difficult to even go through that rigorous approach. It's so difficult to have the money for these loans, process, having families to kind of advocate, support it. How do we navigate that? What are the chances? How many of the doctors here are going to be African-American? Am I going to be one of the 15 that is picked? You know, at the end of the day, all of these things happen sequentially. And then you come back and have to go back to the neighborhood where you reside and you're a role model and you're trying to, you know, let people know it's okay to not be okay. And I'm going to be here so I can support it. I'm not going to stop it, but I'm going to help you kind of navigate this. And it's funny how families come from a predisposed kind of situation, like we talked about earlier. They're impacted. Their emotions are heightened. They don't care who the first person that they see wearing the doctor, you know, cape looks like. That person is going to get it, no matter what that situation is. So being able to offset that, witness a failed surgery, some sort of scenario that was impactful. People, I want you to understand, you know, doctors are just not going to, after this, like 10 minutes later, go down to the deli and be like, can I get a club sandwich? There's a lot that needs to happen mentally to help us reflect. So thank you for sharing about the importance of that dynamic, because I think it's very difficult to balance and will still always be difficult. Even for me, for families, when I lead off, I say, I'm from these streets, not to let them know, hey, because I look like y'all, I'm not going to act like I'm at a higher position. But I say that to say, look, whatever you say, I have either experienced, heard, or done myself. So whenever we're ready, we're going to meet each other where we can to process. And that often takes time. Let's talk about that template piece that you talked about. What would you tell the 10-year-old Rob Gore, who just got beat up and robbed, now that he has this book and you read this book to him? What are things you can now share with him that are in this book to help him feel better?
Wow, that's a great question. I think the first thing that I might suggest is, you know, talk about what happened to you. I want you, you know, let me know how you feel. If you do feel fearful, tell somebody. Because we're taught that emotions are a bad thing. You can be happy, But if there's anything that kind of moves beyond being happy, that's a negative thing. And we don't discuss negative things, because if we discuss negative things, sometimes people think that they can come back and they can consume us, which is part of the issue too. But I think you don't have to dwell on a negative experience, but if something does come up and you're triggered by it, or you have a reminder and it makes you feel very uncomfortable to the point that it's impacting your sleep, it's impacting your safety, I think it should be discussed. I started carrying razor blades to school when I was in middle school because of the experience that I had. I didn't want to. I don't think I'd ever hurt anyone intentionally. I definitely didn't want to use anything. And fortunately, I never used a weapon between the ages, growing up, from when I started carrying razor blades and screwdrivers from age 10, 11 up to 18, I never used them on anyone. Never wanted to. Wouldn't even think of how I could do it in an effective way. They were just kind of props that I would carry. But I would tell my 10, 11-year-old self that there are ways that you can make sure you assess being safe. And I think I did those already, learning to understand the environment and paying a lot more attention of who's around me and my surroundings, but also making sure that I did whatever possible to help regulate a lot of the emotions so that I didn't have to be as fearful. I feel like a lot of the stuff that took place when I was 10 and 11, I would love to say I would do some things differently, but I think I had the support system. You know, after the incident took place, you know, I talked to my parents about what happened. I started doing martial arts. I played sports. And these were ways of kind of regulating my nervous system without even realizing they were regulating my nervous system. When I ran track in high school a lot more extensively, and, you know, training all the time, I could actually sit still and focus for long periods of time. And, and over a period of time, I started realizing, it's like, wow, the more I exercise, the more I can sit still. Wow, this is an incredible experience. Maybe this is why people run. Maybe this is why people play sports. I think now I know the science behind it. And so I think as a curious kid, understanding the science behind the movements and the actions that I took, I think were very important. But I think I was in an exceptionally supportive family who wanted to make sure that I did what was important to regulate my system, to be able to help sit still and even being in a position to be able to process my emotions. Maybe going to therapy at a given point in time might have been a little bit more helpful, but I feel like, you know, I talked to my parents about a lot of this stuff. I couldn't talk to my peers about this stuff. That's the thing. And we would talk about it jokingly, but not like, man, I'm scared, I'm terrified to go over here. You might joke and say, you know what, I'm scared to go to the 90s. And, you know, like, oh yeah, you better protect yourself. We would joke about it, but not to the point to say, you know, wow, I am really terrified of going in a particular neighborhood. I'm scared to the point that I got to smoke weed to regulate. You know, I didn't smoke weed, when I was growing up, but I knew a lot of people who did. And now, knowing why they smoke weed, it wasn't just to get high. A lot of the times they were doing it because they had really, really bad anxiety. And so maybe if some of the folks who would self-medicate, if they understood the science behind the self-medication and figured out other ways, might have put them in a very different position, so they didn't have to walk around high all the time, almost like in a zombie-like state, you know, getting addicted to something that was purely so that they could calm down and hopefully wish they would have known other ways to figure out how to regulate their system and their anxiety.
I just want to, again, commend you for the work, but I know how difficult this is, and so many stories and people that you've been touched by and with. You were quoted before talking about a story that has impacted you. I know that there are many stories that sadden you from time to time. You're just living your life and these things rise up for you. You talk about one of the toughest times, telling a 15-year-old mother that her son was killed. Can you talk to us about that story?
There was a 15, 16-year-old kid who was killed. He was actually killed by the police. And when he was shot multiple times, he came in alive and died in the emergency department. And it was one of the most horrendous things, because I saw him alive and he was mumbling about keeping him alive and shaking. And when I went to go tell the family, you know, you never forget the look of the face of the family members in which you tell these news. You know, they definitely don't forget your face and what you told them. But that young man who was killed by the police, I came back in contact with his family a few years later because his brother was shot multiple times. Mm. It also happened to be on the same day of the funeral of my mentee and one of our former Cavi staff members, and who's an intervention specialist named Willis Young. Willis was stabbed multiple times on July 22nd, 2015, and died in our surgical intensive care unit a couple of weeks later. But he did intervention work in our Department of Emergency Medicine. He provided resources to families who were survivors and victims of intentional trauma. But on July 22nd, he came into that same emergency department as a victim of violence. But the night of his, he died of, a number of weeks later, but the night of his funeral, when I went in to go take care of patients in the trauma emergency department, in our critical care and trauma area, the young man who was killed by the police, his brother came in as a survivor of violence. And when the mother recognized me, she stopped avoiding eye contact. She spoke to me, but she stopped making eye contact. She would ask me questions about what was going on with the status of her son, but I knew why she didn't want to make eye contact. She, as a matter of fact, she even used to have locks all the way down my back, and she recognized me. She said, you cut your hair. Mm. But then when I told her the last bit of information regarding her son, who was the patient with us that night, and letting her know that he needed to stay in the hospital overnight for observation, she looks at me and she said, did my son say anything to you before he died? And she's crying at this point. And then she said, why does this keep happening to my own family? Because she, one son killed, another one who shot, and he was a patient, and she had lost a nephew to violence pretty recently. During that time frame. And I didn't know what to say. Like, I just stopped, my mouth went dry, and I start sweating, and I'm like shaking, and I like said, I'm sorry. And I like ran out of the room and went to the bathroom, and I'm breathing heavy, and I'm having panic attacks. And I'm like, the dry, and I'm trying to control myself, and I'm supposed to be the person who's always in control. You're the physician, you're the person, you're the healthcare provider. You're responsible for this entire medical team and the patients who are there. But now I'm the person who's the patient. How do I go back out there into the room and keep it together? I didn't even feel comfortable enough to tell people that I wasn't feeling well. And during that time frame, I never took a break. I kept coming in back and forth to the hospital. I was the liaison between Willis's family, who was my mentee, who had just died. I was working full-time in the emergency department, full-time as the executive director for Cavi. And I never spent time to take steps away to really process my own emotions or what I was experiencing. On top of that, I was fatigued. I wasn't sleeping. So I'm tired, I'm dysregulated, and I'm working extensively, and I'm taking on other people's trauma. And that moment in the bathroom, that moment in the CCT, our critical care and trauma area, was when everything just kind of hemorrhaged. And I was having a stress response based on all the experiences that I had had, and I couldn't even regulate my own nervous system to the point that I could function. And eventually I wound up going to therapy about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks later, because I was still having those panic attacks every time I came to work. But I can't tell people that I'm having panic attacks, because then they're going to take me out, and then they're going to look at me differently. They're going to look at me differently as, oh, wow, this person can't take it. As now I know so many people have these things, patients, that we've been caring for years have always had this stuff. But you as a provider, you as the person in the position of power, you as the healthcare provider, you're not allowed to be the patient. But here you are, the provider's the patient. And when the provider becomes the patient, nobody does well. When you're on the airplane, people always and they discuss safety. They always say you have to put on your own oxygen mask first before you address the needs of other people around you. I wasn't putting on my own oxygen mask. I worked out, but I didn't sleep. I wasn't taking care of myself. I wasn't talking to people about what was the trauma that I had experienced and the traumas that I had been treating. And so they were just kind of building up. And I think the hard lesson to that, which really, you know, helped improve after I wound up going back to therapy, was that you need to have a time and space to process your emotions. You need to be in a position not to be empathetic, but to really be compassionate, because you want to provide a service to people as a healthcare provider, as an educator, as anyone who's in a helping profession. But once you start taking on the emotions of other people, or you try to connect with people purely on their negative emotions, because you have to show that, you know, that I understand what you've experienced. I feel you. I feel you. I feel you. Once you get to the point that I feel everything that you feel, you take on the stuff from other people.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes infectious to the point that you are no longer who you were, your calm and collected self. You are now a reservoir for somebody else's emotions, which is not the role. Your job is to solve a problem. Your job is not to absorb something else. Who's that superhero that absorbs the energy of other? Gambit? Doesn't Gambit absorb energy? Not Gambit. What's her name? Rogue. You know, you absorb all this energy. You're not supposed to absorb that stuff. That's why she always falls out after absorbing all this power from people. You're not supposed to do that. But you can show love. You can be compassionate. But there has to be a better understanding of how we can connect with people without having to take on their emotions. And that's a hard lesson I learned.
Burnout is real in all professions, but where we're from, we never forget the faces, we never forget the hearts, and we can never listen to the negative emotion because they see that as a weakness. So much to talk about because these moments stick and they're permanent. They're laced where we live and where we are housed. And now you raising your own family, you have to be more protective and you're more worried and you're more concerned about these things. Before we let you go, the floor is yours. Tell our listeners what you want them to remember about you, the movement, and what's up next for this anti-violence platform.
I want to thank everybody for supporting the book. I want to thank everyone for supporting Kavi itself. The movement itself really grew out of a need to provide a resource to the community that wasn't there, or at least wasn't largely publicized. And we grew that from a volunteer-based organization to a very sustainable organization, still continuing the great work and expanding that work within New York City and hopefully outside of New York City. We have been doing a lot more education work so that we can help train other people who have an interest and have a need, so that we don't have people who are out there who are doing this work who are untrained. So I think that this becomes a very important thing. But I tell anybody who's out there who's willing and able, we know that trauma is an experience that somebody has. It doesn't define who they are. We understand the power of support. And so if you're in a position of power, or if you're in a position and have access to resources, see how you can support someone else. And supporting someone else may be being a listening ear. And maybe mentoring. I think anyone who's willing and is able should mentor. Do I think everybody should mentor? Not necessarily, because I think you have to be in the right frame of mind and at least be in a position where you've learned how to process the trauma and the negative experiences that you've had so that you don't project that stuff onto other people. I think that understanding how our minds work and understanding how our bodies work is are very important. Understanding what regulates our system, what doesn't regulate our system, having the means and looking out opportunities to regulate our internal stressors as well as our external stressors. You know, the body doesn't recognize that, you know what the stress is. It just knows that this is an experience of discomfort. And if I experience discomfort, I've got to figure out how to regulate that discomfort. Discomfort is not necessarily a bad thing. But I do think it's important that we process the challenges that we've experienced so that we can use them to build our bodies up, to build our minds up, to become and putting ourselves in the best position to adapt to the challenges and changes that take place in front of us.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gore. Let's process, let's regulate, let's find ways to be effective, because a true fighter is not defined by the battles they win, but by the fumbles, their falls, and their failures. Lessons happen first, success, they happen last. But never give up, because on this platform it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked and labeled. But this is no longer our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town real soon, near you.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde de la Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, mamá. Te extraño mucho.